Good morning again. If you have a Bible with you this morning, I would invite you to open it with me to the book of Exodus, chapter 1. This morning we're going to begin a sermon series that entitled Out of Egypt as we begin in the book of Exodus. As I was preparing for this, one of the things that I realized was that I didn't really understand how the book of Exodus started until I was an adult. I heard the stories as a child of the children of Israel being enslaved in Egypt and of God sending locusts and frogs to free them. And I heard stories of all those things and I knew about their slavery. I remember hearing sermons when I was a kid about them having to make bricks and all of these really difficult things. But it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized, how did they get there? How did these people be enslaved? Why were they in Egypt? Why did God have to take them out of Egypt? Was it something that they did wrong? Was it something they did right? What was going on? How did we get there? And that may be the case for some of you, and some of you may know exactly how they got there. But I want to begin this morning, just by way of introduction, making sure, before we even read Exodus 1, how we get to Exodus 1. Because if we just jump into Exodus 1, it's just like God's people are enslaved, and he's getting ready to take them out. So we need to understand how they got there. And we need to understand that this book, the book of Exodus, while in our Bibles stands alone, really is a continuation of Genesis. So we can't understand Exodus without Genesis. We can't understand how the people got to where they're at and the situation that they're in without understanding Genesis. And the reality is that's the way all of us are. All of us are in a place because of something that happened before. Maybe we're in a good place, maybe we find ourselves not in a great place, but we're all in a place that we're at today because of events that have happened in the past. And that's the same way that it is for God's people here in Egypt in the book of Exodus. So the book of Exodus, again, begins with the book of Genesis, and it begins first with a promise of a great nation. So in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, it says this, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing." And so God promises to Abram, later to Abraham, that he would make a great nation out of him, that he would give them a land, he would give them a place of their very own, and that they would be numerous. So we see that there first was a promise, that God made a promise. And Exodus really is part of the fulfillment of that promise. We see God in his sovereign hand, in his sovereign time, fulfilling the promise that he made to Abraham way back in Genesis chapter 12. The second thing is that there is a dire prophecy. In Genesis chapter 15, verse 13, it says this, "Then he said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. So God makes this amazing promise to Abraham, and then later he says, also, these descendants of yours, this nation of yours that I am building out of you, are going to live in another land. They will be strangers there, they will be slaves there, and they will be afflicted there for 400 years. In Genesis chapter 37 and in 39, what we see is Egypt come into play. And probably a lot of us remember, if not, you can go back and look at this, but you remember the story of Joseph being the youngest son and having the coat of many colors, and that's one of the stories that we talk about all the time, and his brothers being jealous of him and wanting to kill him, but ultimately they decide that they're going to sell him. So they take him out of the pit that they had designed for his death, and they sell him off, and in Genesis chapter 39, Joseph ends up in Egypt, in Potiphar's house. So from where God's promise was in Genesis, now one descendant of Abraham is in Egypt. One is beginning to fulfill that promise of being in that land for 400 years. But as of now, only Joseph is there. And again, the story of Joseph, you should read that if you haven't for a while. The amazing story of God's provision and salvation. And he rises Joseph to prominence until Joseph is basically running the whole country almost. And a famine comes into the land. And Joseph stores up food. And eventually, Joseph's family comes to Egypt looking for food. Joseph's brothers come across Joseph. He recognizes them. They don't recognize him. There's all of these exchanges. And again, we don't have time for all of that. But in Genesis 46 and 47, what happens is Jacob, Joseph's father, Israel, comes to Egypt because they're going to starve to death in their land. And now we have Israel, Jacob, and his children living in Egypt. So that's how they got there. So they live there. Eventually, Jacob dies. Eventually, Joseph dies. And Genesis ends. Then you turn to the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus picks up the story around 300 years later. And the first chapter of the book of Exodus takes about 100 years to all unfold. So when we read this first chapter, it feels like these things are just happening like boom, 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 boom. But they're really not. This is over the course of a period of time. And that matters because how long were they going to stay there? 400 years, because our God is perfect and right every single time. He never makes a mistake. So now we have the descendants of Israel, the children of Israel, living in the land of Egypt. And that's where we pick up in the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 1, verse 1. Follow with me. God's perfect and inspired word says this. Now these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man in his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, all his brothers, and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to the people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen, in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land." Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh cities, Pithom and Rosmas. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, and all manner of service in the field. All their service which they made them serve was with rigor. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name was Shiphrah, and the name of the other was Puah. And he said, "When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live." But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive?" And the midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them." Therefore, God dwelt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mightily. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." So again, we see at the beginning of this the death of Jacob or Israel and his children and that generation. And then we see those generations begin to grow and to blossom and to multiply. And the king then is removed. A new king is brought in. And all of the things that we're going to talk about in the next few weeks anyway are all because of that happening. So the first thing that I want us to understand is that if God is going to save a people, if he's going to do all of these miraculous things of all of the plagues to Egypt, if he's going to lead them out, if he's going to do all of the amazing things, if he's going to part the sea for them to do it, there has to be a people there first to have that happen. He has to build his people. He has to fulfill the promise that he made way back in Genesis chapter 12 to Abram. He has to build that people. They have to grow and they have to multiply in this place. In the first 7 verses, we see them grow, but I want you to notice something about this. There are 3 sections that I want us to see. In each one of them, there is great growth in the people of God. All 3 times, but all 3 times, there's a different situation that they find themselves in with which God grows them. And I'm thankful this morning that even for us as a church who are today God's people, his chosen people out of the world to be his, to save, that he will grow and he will build his church no matter what situation we find ourselves in. That he is a God who overcomes, that he is a God who works through and in no matter what situation the world may have, no matter what opposition the world may have against us. So look with me again in verses 1 through 7. He lists the names in verse 1 and 2. He says, "Now these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man in his household came with Jacob, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And all those were descendants of Jacob, were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied, and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with him." Do you notice what happens in verse 7? A lot of times we talk about in this church, and it's happened a couple of times over the time that I've been here, but we talk about there was a time about 14 to 16 years ago where we had what we refer to as the baby boom. And all of a sudden you would walk into this church and it just seemed like every woman was pregnant. And it just seemed like there were babies everywhere. And what we see here, just listen to the words that he says. They were fruitful, they increased abundantly, they multiplied, they grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. So what we see is that God took 70 people that he had placed in this land by his grace. Remember, they are in this land because of the goodness and the sovereignty of God. They are in this land literally because God has saved them. If they would have stayed where they were, they would have certainly died. And they've come to Egypt to escape famine. They've come because God, in his grace, has made a way through one man, Joseph. God saved his people, like us, right? Through one man, he saves us and he brings them into this place. And it's by his grace that they're there and they're living in grace. We need to understand that if we read chapter 1 in the context, they're not always slaves, are they? They come into the land and they live freely. In fact, in Genesis chapter 47, verse 27, it says this, "So Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there and grew and multiplied exceedingly." So when the people came to Egypt, Pharaoh didn't say, "Well, listen, Jacob, you and your children can stay here, but you're going to be my slaves." No. Rather, because he had such an amazing relationship with Joseph, because he loved Joseph and he cared for Joseph so much, he said, "Rather, you can come and you can live here, and I will give you a place to be, and you can be shepherds, and you can care for the flocks, and you can be employed, and you can have all of these things." And so even in Egypt, the people are living under the grace of God. It is in his goodness that they are there. They are experiencing life and freedom because of the goodness of God in their lives. And in the midst of that goodness, in the midst of that grace, they multiply. And because of that, we get verse 7. We get this exceedingly, abundantly, fruitful multiplication of the people. And they grow, and they grow, and they grow. And God's people grow while under his goodness and grace. Here's what I would submit to you this morning if we're going to apply this to our lives. I would submit to you that those of us who are God's people who live where we live, probably as much or more than anyone else in the entire world today, are living under the grace of God. Now, there are plenty of things about our nation, the way things work, the way things run, that I am not exceedingly joyful about. But here's what I would say. We are more free than any people in the entire planet. We have more opportunity than anybody in the world today. We live under less fear of persecution than probably any other Christian people in the world today. And we do that not because we are better, not because we deserve it, not because we have earned it, but we do that because of the grace of God in our lives today. If you came here freely this morning, you came here freely because of the goodness and the grace of God in your life. And my prayer would be that the church, that God's people, would grow exceedingly and abundantly within the grace of God. That we would take advantage of the freedom that we have. That we would take advantage of the ease with which we live. That we would take advantage of the goodness of God in our lives. That we would share the gospel freely. That we would share and display the love of God freely with those who are around us. That we would use that grace and not take it for granted and not make it a crutch which would hold us up, but rather that we would use it for the glory of God. I pray that we would be a people who would recognize the goodness of God in our lives. Rather than that make us lazy, rather than that make us selfish, that we would use that freedom for His glory, that we would use that prosperity for His glory, that we would take advantage of where we live. These people multiplied exceedingly and greatly under the grace of God. And God builds His people in the midst of situations like this. And I know that in the culture that we live in today, it seems like we may be the minority. We probably are. It seems like the world may be fighting against us more increasingly. But I say to you, the gates of hell will not prevail against the church. Jesus will build His church, period. And I pray that it's our prayer and our desire that He would build it here. That we would not be content with where we are or who we are. That we would seek to continue to reach out with the gospel to our neighbors and to the nations. So first we see that they grew exceedingly in the grace of God. But it's important for us who live in that to recognize that that's not the only way that God can grow His people. That God can grow His people in any situation, in any place, anywhere, however He sees fit, whenever He sees fit, according to His plan. And we see Him do that in the next few verses. So look with me in verses 8 through 14. So in verses 1 through 7, they are growing exceedingly in the grace of God. And now in verse 8, we see a transition. And again, this is years after verse 7 ends. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than me. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us and so go up out of the land." Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and brick and all manner of service in the field. And their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. And so for a couple of hundred years or so, God's people have been living in this land freely, multiplying freely, growing freely. Joseph dies, Joseph's brothers die, that whole generation dies, and a new king is brought in. Now we need to understand when it says that there's a new king, that word new doesn't necessarily mean that a lot of times kings grew in succession. So he was king and then his son would take over being king and his son would take over being king. But in this case, it probably means that there was a new king from somewhere else. That this king regime had been overthrown and someone else had come in. Many people believe there was a group of people that were also shepherds, and they believe that maybe this man was from them, and they knew the children of Israel well because of being shepherds, and so there was part of the tension. I don't know if that's 100% accurate, but that's what some people believe. But nevertheless, there's a new person, there's a new king, there's a new Pharaoh, and he doesn't know who Joseph is. He doesn't know of the amazing things that Joseph has done. He doesn't know of the way in which Joseph almost single-handedly saved the nation of Egypt by saving back food in the midst of this famine. He doesn't know of all the incredible things that Joseph had done in his life. And he looks out at these people and he says, "Whoa, there's way too many of them. If an army comes and they join with them, they'll overtake us. There's too many of them." And so he begins to decide that they're going to make them slaves. But before we talk about the idea of them being slaves, I just want to remind you of something. And I'm not trying to make any prophecies or anything like that. I'm just saying this. The freedom that you live in is not a guarantee. The way that we live as people where we live today is not a promise from God. Now, the freedom that you have in Christ for the believer is. But the freedom that we live in socially and nationally, the grace with which we live in here, is not a guarantee. You could wake up tomorrow and there could be a new sheriff in town and things could be very much different. And our dependence must not be on who is in the White House or where we live or the government with which we live under, but our dependence should be to our King, King Jesus. Our trust should be in Him and in His nation and who He is. Because that's what happens. I'm sure that most of the children of Israel thought they had it easy and it was going to be great. We're just going to continue to live here. We're going to continue to be shepherds. We're going to continue to multiply. Everything's going to be great and we'll just live out our days here. And then all of a sudden, there's a new Pharaoh and he doesn't know who Joseph is. So in verse 9, the new Pharaoh addresses the people of Egypt and he says, "Look, the children of Israel are more and mightier than we." He says they're mightier than us. Now, I don't think that the Pharaoh really believed that head-to-head, the children of Israel win in a battle. I think, one, he's concerned about them joining in with another army. By now, there's over a million of them, by the way. 70 to millions in a few hundred years. But I do think he wants his people to fear them. He wants his people to hate them because they will only carry out his tasks if they do. So he causes the Egyptian people to have a fear and a hatred of God's people. So he enslaves them. So why would he make them slaves? I think there's a couple of reasons. First, for personal control, and second, for population control. He wants to beat the life out of these people. He wants them to live in fear of him. He wants them to believe that there's no way out. He wants them to see the Egyptian people as superior and stronger and that there's no way out. And so I think in some level he's playing a bit of a mind game, but I think even more than that, he's simply trying to control the population. His plan is literally to work them to death. I'm going to work you making bricks and building cities and building buildings until you die. And if you get sick, too bad, you keep working. If you don't feel well, too bad, you keep working and you work to death. So his plan is that he's going to weed them out and he's going to make them less of a people. And in the process, he's going to get what he wants. So it's a win-win for him. Those who he perceives as his potential enemy decrease in strength, one in numbers, but also just in strength. So he's beating the life out of these people, seeking to control the population. He enslaves them mentally, emotionally, and physically. He seeks to rule their life. There, what seems to be the grace of God has left. But what happens? Look at verse 12. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were in dread of the children of Israel. Pharaoh's great plan of population control backfires completely. The harder they got, the more they worked them, the more they abused them, the more that they didn't care for them, the more that they sought that they die, the more they increased. God is building his people. He is making a great nation, and no Pharaoh and no slaveholder and no nation can get in his way. It matters not how difficult the situation is. God is constructing his nation. He is making for himself a people, and nothing will get in the way of that. They begin to multiply exceedingly. Here's the reality for us. Growth can be measured in lots of different ways and areas in our lives. But the reality is that most times growth happens in difficult situations in our lives, doesn't it? It's in the times of difficulty that God grows us personally. It's in the times of challenge where we grow. And we've seen internationally that many times the more that the nations or the enemy seek to squelch the gospel, seek to squelch the church of God, what happens? The church of God grows even more. Not because the church of God is strong, but because the God of the church is strong. Because he accomplishes his purposes. We'll see in a minute that God may use the very thing that Pharaoh is trying to use to destroy the people to actually grow them. So first, God grows his people in grace. Second, he grows them in the midst of slavery. They have multiplied. They just keep growing. They just keep coming. So now Pharaoh's faced with a decision. Now what am I going to do? Now what? That plan is not working. In fact, that plan seems to be doing the opposite of what I wanted it to do. So what's his plan next? Well, as evil does. It grows and it gets worse and it gets worse and it gets worse. And the hatred grows and the sin grows. And that's what happens. In verses 15 through 22, it says this. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Sifra and the name of the other was Puah. And he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? But the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. For they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. Therefore, God dwelt with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mightily. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. Now the sin and the depravity of Pharaoh goes another level. And he gathers these two midwives. We need to understand that these two midwives probably weren't the only midwives in Egypt. There are millions of Israelites there by now, so they're probably the lead. And he says, I want you to kill the boys. If it's a girl, let them go. So he gives them a death sentence. And he says, before that mother can even know what's happened, I want you to take advantage of the situation and I want you to kill that child. I want you to murder them. So again, he sees that he needs the population to be smaller if he wants the power that he's going to have. He desires that the male children be killed rather than the females, not because of some sort of grace in the females. He plans to use and abuse those women, but because he knows that those boys would be strong in battle, would be potential leaders who could potentially rise up against him. So he seeks to control the population by murdering children. We're not going to go too far down this road, but we need to understand that that is exactly what happens in the United States of America today. Many people in this nation would tell you, if you are a woman and you have a pregnancy and you think that that might be too many, you should just kill that child. We've moved past the old arguments and we are now simply into population control. So he seeks to wipe out a whole generation of young men. But these midwives are going to have none of it. These midwives, they're the hero of this chapter. In fact, they're the only two people outside of just naming off the children of Israel who have a name in this chapter. We don't even know what the Pharaoh's name is. Who cares about him? These women are the heroes. These women say, we're not going to do it. You can kill me. You can torture me. You can fire me. You can do whatever you want to do, but I'm not going to do this. So they saved those children. They fought for the innocent. They put their life on the line for the sake of those who were innocent and helpless. Church, we ought to be that same people. We can't sit back forever and just let the innocent and the helpless be murdered in our country and act like we don't care. At some point, we've got to stand up and say, this is murder and everybody knows it. But here what we see is these women won't do it. Now, we don't know exactly what happened. There's a lot of different theories about how these women saved these boys' lives. Some people think that they got there, they did their normal duty, they delivered their child, and then when Pharaoh came, they just lied to him. Here's what I think happened. This is pure conjecture on my part. I think when they met with that woman after she was pregnant, they said something like this, do not call me until the very last second. And if you think you can do this on your own, do it. And then I think when they got a call, when the person come running to them and said, hey, so-and-so's in labor, they said, okay, I'm baking bread. And they just kind of slow rolled it. And they came in and said, oh, look, here he is. She's already got him. I don't know if that's what happened or not, but here's what I know. I know that they fought for the innocent and they defied the government when the government told them to sin. And they said, we will honor God and his creation and his image bearers, and we will not do this. Here's the other part about this that I think is interesting. I don't think this was just about those midwives. Look at verse 19. Pharaoh comes and he tells them, what are you doing? You're not doing what I said to do. None of this is working. And the midwife said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, for they are lively. In fact, it's believed that if you do the regular multiplication from 70 to where they are when they leave Egypt, you can't get from here to there without many, many, many women having multiple children at a time. The math doesn't add up unless they're having twins and triplets. But here's what I think. I think the God of the universe, who said in Genesis that you will have trouble in childbearing, I think the God of the universe said, today you won't, and that child's going to come. He didn't take all the pain away. I'm not saying that, but he might have. But I think that he allowed them quick and effective deliveries in order to save those kids' lives because they are his kids, because God is building his people, because God will build his people in the midst of his grace. He will build his people in the midst of slavery and difficulty, and he will build his people in the midst of severe persecution with the threat of death, and God wins. And I don't know where we go from here. We may live in this country another 500 years in the same freedom or better freedom than we have, and it may turn bad quickly. I have no idea, but here's what I know. God will build his church, because in Matthew chapter 16, verses 17 and 18, Jesus says this, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock, I will build my church. And the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. This was the gates of hell seeking to destroy the people of God, and they could not prevail. This was God building his people that he had chosen for his pleasure, for his glory, so that he could miraculously deliver them and bring them to their own land. Church, today I pray that we would be people who would take advantage of the freedoms that we have, that we would be people in the midst of difficulty, in the midst of persecution, in the midst of struggle, would trust that God will still build his church, that we would be faithful, that we would not act in fear, but that we would act in faith, knowing that God is good and that God is in control of all things on all days.